also, I suppose the thing about an interlinear to this picture should be about Michelangelo Antonioni. In this period, they had what they call the art film.
Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. That voice was Jack Nicholson talking on a DVD commentary track for a film we will be talking about shortly. We're battening down the hatches here in Chicago, and anything else that needs battening. The snow is horizontal. We're expecting to measure tonight's accumulation in feet instead of inches. So it's the perfect night for a podcast. We're calling this one The American, The Passenger, The Town, and The Void. Sounds like the setting for a Samuel Beckett play, but it's actually a conversation that begins with George Clooney. J. Robert Parks and I are going to talk about his film from last fall called The American, and it's worth talking about, but it's also an excuse to talk about one of my favorite filmmakers, Michelangelo Antonioni, and you'll see why in a moment and what Jack Nicholson has to do with that. And then that leads us into Destinations Unknown. You won't believe this, but we'll actually be back in the coming weeks, not too long, with separate conversations about True Grit, Black Swan, and a talk about rewatching movies many years after you first saw them to see if your opinions have changed. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good.
Today we'll talk about the movie called The American. And I remember hearing about this movie, I don't know, maybe in the summer, saw a trailer or two. And then I found out that it was opening up on early September. The trailer actually was kind of interesting. It's George Clooney in sort of, you know, typical George Clooney role, looking suave and debonair and in Europe. And apparently he's some kind of, spy or something. And then I found out the movie was being released in early September, which, of course, is usually the death knell for film. It's often, you know, why the heck is going on here? And so I just sort of wrote it off, figured it must be terrible. And then the reviews came out, and the reviews were halfway decent. So I found myself to a theater and saw it, and I wouldn't say I was pleasantly surprised, but I enjoyed myself. It's a movie about, well, again, George Clooney. He's not exactly a spy, though. He's a craftsman in the best sense of that word, although his craft is that he creates custom guns, probably for other spies. But the movie opens and with this fairly... shocking is maybe too strong a word, but surprising moment of George Clooney being attacked by two men, and he's able to show off what an amazing shooter he is as he kills them both quickly. But it sort of means that he's on the run, or at least sort of on the run, and so he heads to Italy, where he gets this job to build this very advanced sort of sniper rifle. And the movie is mostly about him in Italy making this gun. One of the things he's learned from the incident at the beginning is that he probably shouldn't have any friends, because his friends might very well betray him. That leads him in Italy to sort of avoiding all kind of contact, with the exception of a priest who he has some conversations with, and then this very, very beautiful prostitute, as only can be true in the movies. But I found the movie enjoyable in a lot of ways. It's quite slow, and so I think for some people it might be... certainly slower than they would expect, but it reminded me of sort of existential films that I've seen in the past, despite the fact that it's a relatively straightforward story of a man and his gun and his girl. What'd you think?
His gun that he's building for someone else.
Yes.
You get the feeling that he is a craftsman, but also that maybe he's been the assassin or marksman in the past. Mm. You know, he wants out of this business. He has
of course.
He has one last job. He's going to build one last gun. There's not even any shooting involved, I believe. The person who his boss, his remote boss, who he contacts via
payphone
only, tells him, yeah. So he mostly doesn't seem that interested in his work, I guess. He's mostly interested in sort of being in this picturesque European town, village.
Yes, beautifully photographed.
Yeah.
I mean, Italy has never looked so good.
From above, you know, these windy roads, and it's just this little, you know, quaint village. I don't know, do villages like this still exist?
Well, in the movies.
They do in the movies. Yeah. With those prostitutes in town. Yeah, my first reaction on this is that I love that George Clooney, big movie star who can make whatever he wants, is interested in making a movie like this. Mm-hmm. By this, I mean a movie that's a little bit slow, taking its time, or at least sort of has the trappings of a lot of the kind of movies that are willing to just linger in a town and soak it up a little bit. In fact, what I didn't like about the movie was that it feels like it has sort of Hollywood elements grafted onto that in a way that sort of rush it along and move the plot and have plot, basically, where it would be nice to just kind of sit and soak for a while.
Are you thinking of like, because one of the parts that didn't work for me was sort of this guy who seems to be, you know, stalking or trailing George Clooney. That seemed very Hollywood-y to me. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
There has to be a lot of suspense, and there has to be, you know, that he's on the run in a sense, even though he's in one spot. He's sort of trying to hide out, and there's also this the religious questions of his. You know, he seems to question himself, or he's already given up on himself, or something, which feel very, you know, on paper very sort of European art film-ish, but here for some reason felt really simple. I don't know if it's because the priest just sort of pops out of the woodwork and says, "Ah, I'm an American. Well, let's talk about this for a while." But to the film's credit, the priest himself seems to have a complicated past as well. It's not like we're looking at light and dark here or good and bad. They're both complicated people. Mm-hmm. The priest, it seems, has a son, a grown son.
Right.
We don't know much more than that, but there's some, there may be some reason he's drawn to someone who has a complicated past like George Clooney's character.
Yeah. Yeah, the priest is an interesting character, and I think I agree that it's not altogether successful. The questions they have are the discussions they have revolve around questions that are, you know, sort of the big questions of life, and yet somewhat simply discussed. And maybe that's true to how most people would discuss them, but it feels a bit shallow in the movie. And yes, the priest, you know, just always seems to pop up at the time when he's supposed to pop up. Again, as is true of movies, it's not quite as integrated maybe into the plot as we would hope.
Yeah, in some ways it felt like a movie made by someone who loves Antonioni, for example, but made by someone who fears that the audience might not love Antonioni and therefore needs a little injection here and there from something. Antonioni, of course, is one of my all-time favorites, and we can get to that in a little while.
Yeah. Which Antonioni does this sort of remind you most of?
The Passenger, I think, is a movie where Jack Nicholson stars, actually, and it's an English-language film about a guy who's kind of a loner and who lifts out of his life and ends up accidentally adopting someone else's. There's this weapons theme in that because it seems like it's a weapons dealer who he has assumed the role of. But that movie, which is typical of Antonioni, really does linger for long periods of time. Very little happens for long stretches, and any sort of plot advancement is very subtle, to the point that people sometimes don't even see it happen or can't explain when it has gone from A to B to C, even though it has. Antonioni is a master of that sort of thing, and I love that somebody wants to make, you know, I got the feeling George Clooney said, I wish I had the opportunity that Jack Nicholson had to be in an Antonioni movie. Hey, we could do that. Yeah, you know, we can do that. And I love that someone of his stature is willing to try to make something like The Passenger. But I think that if Antonioni or someone like that had made this movie, then it would have been more interested in a lot of these existential questions about life instead of sort of skimming their surface. And when you boil down this plot, you realize how very simple the whole thing is, even to the point of they introduce some red herrings in the plot. For example, he falls in. I think we have to spoil maybe a little bit here. He falls in love with the local beautiful prostitute, and she him, because I don't know why this sort of makes me laugh, but let's just suppose that happens.
Yes. Yes. The reason why it happens is also kind of silly, and only in the movie's kind of moment, I think.
Yeah, well, no one's ever pleasured her like that.
No.
And then chastised her right after for confusing the direction of the pleasure. That was very strange. You can't second guess why people love what they love in the movies. But
it all feels more plausible when this red herring sort of enters the picture of, you know what, maybe she's out to get him. Mm. You know, this would make perfect sense that she gets close to him in this yeah. way, that it's all too good to be true. And sometimes yeah. things that are too good to be true have a reason for being too good yeah. to be true. When a lot of the red herrings in this movie fall away
yeah.
Is all I will say mm-hmm. About that, I guess. But it'd be nice if some of them stuck.
Yeah, I agree. For me, the red herrings are a bit frustrating, just because sometimes they feel a bit hokey. But I liked the movie enough, almost in spite of them. In part, I'm a huge George Clooney fan. And just sort of, I like when he's sort of playing straight action hero, but I like when he's even more, a bit more introspective, as he is here. That sense of I don't know, he has a presence about him. There's scenes where he's just sort of sitting on a bed, kind of leaned over, and the director, I'll butcher his name, but Anton Corbijn, I think, films him from behind in silhouette. And it's just really, I don't know, fascinating to watch Clooney, and you just sort of imagine what he's thinking. And I found that very just captivating, and it really had me going. And just sort of trying to stay one step ahead of Clooney. You know, what is he afraid of? What does he want to do? What does he think the end game is here? I mean, he's in a dangerous situation, and yet he's not moving. Why not? And so I found those questions interesting. I think in part because I find how Clooney played this character interesting. And so for me, it was easier to overlook what I think are fairly clearly flaws in the film, because I was enjoying the rest of it, and I was interested. You know, I was interested to see, you know, can he get out of this? Is there a way for him to actually, you know, do what happens so rarely in films, which is the guy gets away from his past, so to speak. It's interesting you had brought up Antonioni, because I was thinking the same. But I got thinking about European art house even before that, the very first scene, because the first scene takes place in Sweden, in this, you know, sort of little cottage in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by snow. And it suddenly is like, oh, we've entered Bergman territory. and again, the George Clooney being this sort of existential character, again, felt very Bergman-like. And so for the rest of the movie, I had sort of my European art house antenna up. And there's not much else about Bergman, I think, in the film, except maybe the priest, but that's doesn't have the depth that Bergman did. But I think the film is clearly sort of playing with these European art house tropes, and trying to bring them back into a Hollywood framework in some way, and the fusion probably doesn't work quite as well, but I kind of applaud the effort anyway.
Yeah, in some ways, I'm of two minds about George Clooney in particular, but it ties in with what you just said. He's a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are certain people who are, I sort of categorize people in these two categories, being, you know, there's the movie star and there's the actor. The actor disappears into roles. The movie star is always Julia Roberts is always Julia Roberts, and
that's
people
right.
love Julia Roberts and want to see her be Julia Roberts
that's
in various
right.
situations.
Yeah.
And what's really cool, though, is when someone like that is willing to sort of give their, not only their career for a little while, but their persona over
yeah.
to a really powerful director
mm-hmm.
who can manipulate it in some interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of what Hitchcock did with Jimmy Stewart,
yeah.
taking the everyman that everyone loves and putting him in these slightly unsavory situations,
mm-hmm.
but in these very gradual ways so that you're with him all along, mm-hmm. and then you find that you're also in
yeah.
those situations. But I don't think George Clooney does that here necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as I think he likes this type of, or it seems interested in doing this type of movie, it's very much flattering of him still. It's
yeah.
still very much George Clooney himself. It would be interesting to see someone take whatever it is that is George Clooney.
And strip it out?
Well, and somehow play with it a little bit in ways that are a little more surprising than this.
Yeah.
What Antonio did with Jack Nicholson is also also fits in that mold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always kind of wondered what Jack Nicholson thought of that movie, in
mm.
fact. It was re-released a few years ago and was not in wide circulation before that.
Right.
And I had heard that, and I believe this is true, that Jack Nicholson owns the film.
Mm-hmm. I'd heard that too.
And I always wondered why, you know, does he hate the movie?
Mm.
You know, it's not, you always hope that these people who took a chance and,
yep.
you know, Not a lot of Hollywood stars were in Antonioni's films, and you always like to think that, well, if they finally were able to do that, maybe they would love the experience or love what came out of it, even though The Passenger is not anything that would ever be popular in Hollywood or, right. you know, that not a lot of people have seen. But then, have you ever heard the commentary track that he recorded on the DVD for that? Jack Nicholson did the commentary track on the DVD, and it's one of my favorite commentary tracks.
Why so?
He is, first of all, reverential. He loves the movie.
Oh. Huh.
He whispers through the whole thing because he says that he feels funny talking over it.
Oh.
But at the same time, he has all these very interesting things to say that show that he has thought a lot about the movie and about the character and about what it means and what it's about. And in that movie, his character is off in the Middle East somewhere on business, sort of sharing this very little hotel with one other Westerner, who then dies fairly early in the film. And for unclear reasons, Nicholson's character decides that he will trade places with him.
Right.
We don't really know what's going on in his life, but he, you know, changes the photos on their passports. He drags the body into his room. Nobody there knows him or this other guy very well, and so it was very easy for him to just sort of become this other person. But then he finds he sort of accidentally begins assuming parts of this guy's life that he didn't intend to. You know, he meets with people who are in this guy's date book, things like that, just because of the, you know, he's in the right place at the right time. And Nicholson had this interesting comment about that. Why does he do this? Because a man needs a path. And I thought that was such a, that is, in some ways, that is the movie distilled into one little phrase. A man needs a path. You can't do what I think this character wanted to do, which is completely detached from life. There are, Antonioni has these great images of that, where he's in a tram crossing a chasm, and he leans out and puts, you know, to get a good view, and Antonioni shoots it so that you see none of the tram, only his body out, like floating like a bird over this chasm. It's great. And yet the character can't truly do that. So it's a fascinating thing to hear him sort of reveal his thoughts about the movie. And then also the ending of the movie is justifiably famous. If people don't remember anything but the ending, it's for a reason. It's just a spectacular shot, basically, a single shot. And there are so many things you could always ask about why Antonioni did things the way he did. And the reason that I always love him as a filmmaker is that he was very thoughtful, always questioning the world, but also a technical master, so that he could do things that you'd wonder how he did them, even as they're still provoking you poetically and thoughtfully about the theme of the movie. You know, they're not simply flashy. And I think what I wouldn't want is for someone who spent a lot of time with Antonioni working on this movie to sit down and tell us, here's what this means. And Nicholson seemed to know that, and instead gives us a little hint about how it was shot, technically, and why, you know, how the camera moves, and he, the way he sort of talks about the shot is really, really compelling, without spoiling any of the magic of what the film is about, I think. So anyway, I don't listen to a lot of commentary tracks myself, but I just have been drawn into this one so much. I think that so pleased to hear someone who is, you know, as big as George Clooney, but loves this type of movie and loves the fact that he was in one.
We first became aware of Antonioni with a picture called La Ventura. And this picture, The Passenger, was probably the biggest adventure in filming that I ever had in my life. I feel it's different for me narrating this kind of film, watching the pace of this. You don't want to interfere with what he's actually saying about the different rhythms of life. Matter of fact, Antonioni is not melodramatic. He likes to observe in the simplest form, let the time pass as it does, and you see things rather than hear them. Not even a return wave. All this space, so few people.
It's interesting you talk about this sort of a man needs a path. And as I saw a movie last week called The Town, which is a Ben Affleck film, and probably a lot of listeners have know about it and maybe even seen it. But it's another movie where we have a criminal of some kind who wants to get out. In this case, he doesn't necessarily want to get out at the beginning, but he falls in love with this woman. And that sort of provokes him to realize, wait, I don't want to live this life the way I've been living it for the rest of my life. And so the woman becomes theoretically the path or the way he can get out of this. It's nowhere near on the level of The Passenger. It doesn't, to maybe Ben Affleck's credit, the movie isn't trying to answer or ask any sort of really deep existential questions. It's a fairly straightforward, very well acted crime drama. But it's interesting, again, to think about if you're going to tell a story of a man who's been a criminal, who then wants to leave his life of crime, which isn't quite the story of The Passenger, but there's elements to that, what path is available to him? And one of the things that I really, really like about The Town is that it has a very, very strong sense of place. That Ben Affleck's character and the other people in his group, his gang, so to speak, all come from this one neighborhood in Boston called Charleston. And and it's because they are so much from this place that Ben Affleck can't quite get away. And so that sense of place is really, really strong. And for me, it's one of the real strengths of that film. Not to sidetrack us completely off the American, but
no, yeah.
It just hearing you talk sort of made me think of The Town in sort of pleasant ways. So it's interesting. The American is directed, as I mentioned, by Anton Corbijn, who I saw his big debut at Toronto a few years ago called Control, which was a biopic about the lead singer of Joy Division, who committed suicide at the age of 23. And the movie is actually quite good, particularly given certain limitations of, you know, following a rock star who commits suicide at 23 and the cliches that go with that. But I remember as I watched that film, I was thinking, oh, this guy's going to be really huge in Hollywood because he just has style to spare. And that movie was in sort of black and white CinemaScope, and just it was really, really slick. And you can sort of see that come through in The American too, I think.
Yeah, it's a great looking movie.
Yeah.
It's and it has a certain, you know, I'm sort of laughing about the plot and simplicity of some of the elements, but it has a certain elegance, the mm-hmm. way it all comes together, I think. Mm-hmm. And I also always feel kind of bad when I feel a movie hasn't justified why two people fell in love, mm-hmm. because, you know, why does that happen in real life either? Yeah. I don't know. You can't. It's one of those things you can't explain. And so sometimes I have to stop myself and think, well, this is a movie about what do you do if that you have, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. what if you really did? So you fall in love with this woman and you're trying to get out of this situation. How do you do that when you may know more than you should?
Yeah.
You've been given up on by, you know, you have a choice. You can stay on your path.
Yep.
Or you can cease to exist.
Yeah. No, that's right.
That is someone's idea of what you can do.
So. Right. And in The Town, it's the same thing where, because the girl that Ben Affleck meets, doesn't know that he's a bank robber, doesn't know that he's a criminal. Now, you know that at some point the shoe's going to drop and she's going to find out. But how that happens in the movie, I think, actually has substance. It's not, but it fits sort of with what you're talking about with The American.
Now, did you think at all about Jean-Pierre Melville?
Oh, well, I was watching this. You know, I didn't, but that's a nice comparison.
He's another European filmmaker from decades past who had a very crisp style, mm-hmm. But often dealt with gangsters and guns and you know, that sort of thing.
Well, and solitary men, yeah. That sort of the loners in that criminal world.
Often played by Alain Delon. Delon. I'm probably not saying that right at all.
Yeah, no, that's a nice link. I haven't seen Melville in a while, except for Army of Shadows, which is quite a bit of a different film. But
yeah.
But no, you're right. That's there's a lot of that too.
Army of Shadows is his one war film, basically, yeah. Where the others are sort of more trench coat kind of things.
Yes. Yeah. And Melville also had style to spare.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a nice. It is. I think the movie. It's hard to get away from sort of that art house influence. The movie wears it on its sleeve and.
And proudly. Mm-hmm. And I this is another thing that I think I'm a little of two minds about, because it's great to see this, but it's such a stark difference from what typically comes out of Hollywood that I'm reminded that you can't really make movies like this anymore, mm-hmm. or at least rarely. You know, yeah. if you're someone like George Clooney who can, he can burn one because he's popular and they'll let him do what he wants, but then he needs to go back and make a big one.
Yeah.
You can do that. And if I wish more people would sort of do that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it is a reminder that you don't see this sort of thing very often. And I hate to analyze box office receipts to mean anything, mm-hmm. and normally we don't do that. But no. I did read Roger Ebert, or I believe it was, talking about how it had a huge opening weekend. Surprisingly, I believe it won the weekend. Mm-hmm. And then a huge drop-off, yeah. which implies that, you know, maybe the movie was sold as something that it isn't or something like that. But I think it shows the danger of someone like Clooney doing something that sort of looks on the outside like other movies he's made,
yeah.
drawing people who want to see that, and it's not that at all.
Right, right, it is. And it points to the area in which critics could really be helpful. You know, if people were more of a mind to sort of trust critics than they are, and they could sort of read and they could go, oh, yeah, maybe this isn't quite what I wanted. Because I think pretty much every critic who wrote about it mentioned that it was slow. You know, mentioned that it wasn't quite, you know, an action thrill ride. Because I think that is sometimes what critics will do, is they'll say, you're probably expecting this, but you don't want to expect that. You want to sort of realize it's more this, and hopefully you're in the mood for that, but just sort of know going in, this is what it's going to be. Because mm-hmm. I think those expectations, we've talked a lot about this on the podcast, but I think, you know, if you go in expecting a slam bang action movie, and then you don't get it, even if the movie is good, it might be really hard to make that transition from what you were expecting to what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Because you go to a movie with a certain... you go to a movie for a reason, you know? I feel like this tonight. but I still come back to this idea that the town we're watching is slow, mm-hmm. the character is slow, mm-hmm. but I feel like the movie is a little bit zippy.
Okay.
Not in terms of... I have to qualify that, because it's not... I understand why some people would be disappointed if they were expecting a thriller, because it's not that kind of zippy. It's not the kind of zippy that pulls you along. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of zippy that is like, oh, I wish we could have stayed and watched that a little bit while longer. Mm-hmm. Oh, I wish we could have just sat in that cafe. Mm-hmm. I think a really inquisitive filmmaker will see the 1,000 things that are interesting about this spot and let us discover them too. Put the camera in a place that allows those to come across. or some small number of them anyway, where this one just needs to keep moving.
Yeah, yeah. You seen anything else recently? Anything that you liked or didn't like?
Well, I guess it's interesting that we talk about how style and the story sort of sometimes mesh, sometimes clash. I saw Enter the Void, the new movie by Gaspar Noé. Mm-hmm. He made a movie a few years ago called Irreversible that was... extremely stylish, as we're talking about these stylish movies. I mean, this is the type of movie where it's very... Did you see Irreversible?
No, I know my limits.
Okay. This is beyond most people's limits, yeah. Irreversible. And this guy has such a grasp of what he's doing. I mean, I really feel that the movies he has made, they are exactly what he intended to make. And they are the types of things that have these strobe effects and that have looping timelines. They have special effects that recreate scenes that I'm not sure anyone would actually want to spend time seeing. Yeah. You know, a rape, for example, in a very long take that leaves nothing to the imagination. And so with that film, I felt like in some way it's sort of impressive what he's done, and yet I hate this movie. I really hate this movie. And I don't want to spend time talking about Irreversible, but I was drawn back in to see another film of his, Enter the Void, the new one, because a number of people who I follow, Scott Tobias and a few other folks, think it's really a cinematic experience.
Okay.
You know, it's something that you're not likely to see very often. And I think that's true. It is similar to Irreversible in a lot of ways, that, you know, he's depicting a lot of stuff that you're not going to see very often. Very graphic situations. But also, if you boil the story down, it is so silly and simple that I really don't want to say what it is, because I almost feel like it's unfair to the movie.
No.
It hinges on this idea that this brother has told his sister that he will never leave her.
Okay.
And the movie wants to take that literally as far as you possibly can past death in these extremely simplistic ways. And he meant that. He really meant that. And he will go beyond what you would ever expect and beyond what she would expect you'd think to satisfy that promise. It's also the kind of movie, though, that I can't figure out how it was done. Mm. You know, and this is what's so impressive about it. You know, if you had $100 million...
You mean like technically?
Technically. If you had $100 million, you could make this movie.
Okay.
I don't know how you can do it if you have whatever he had, which surely wasn't $100 million, right. You know? This is a small art house movie. It looks fantastic. It takes place in Tokyo, but it's a Tokyo where the buildings are sort of outlined in neon. Mm. A very large percentage of the movie is shot overhead, looking down, sort of like that last shot of Taxi Driver.
Okay.
You know, we move from room to room in that way.
Yeah.
And it's partly because there's sort of a disembodied soul that is sort of drifting around. Ah. It's able to see into body parts. It's able to enter people's heads. It's able to move from room to room. Mm. And it's really fascinating the way his camera can move. And at the end of the day, I just want to ask, why put all of that ability and talent into telling this story? Mm. I don't have an answer for that.
Do you think it's, and again, I haven't seen it, do you think it's purely an exercise in style? I mean, is he made an intentionally simplistic story so he can do whatever the heck he wants?
It's so strong stylistically that it makes me want to fight this impulse to pull the style apart from the story.
Okay.
Maybe they are one and the same. Maybe it's not fair to say, well, it's just style. Mm. It's no story. Maybe the story is purposely elemental. Mm-hmm. You know, it has only a few key elements, and they are so simple anyone could understand them, and they are the spine of this very complex visual story. Mm. There's also something kind of cool at the beginning. A lot of this hinges on this this Book of the Dead, Tibetan Book of the Dead, and there are also a lot of drugs involved, so that's why Tokyo sort of looks like an LSD dream. But there's a point where a guy has already taken quite a bit of stuff, and he might be taking some more, he says to someone, and the guy says, no, you're going to fry your brain. You should read the Book of the Dead that I loaned you instead. That'll really... I sort of liked the idea that this literature was on a par with these hallucinogenics that they're taking. And I think that since the book sort of represents the story of the film, and the drugs represent the style of the film, I think merging those two in some ways is the impulse behind the movie. Mm. I don't know.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's interesting enough to make me want to see it, but it sounds interesting at least.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. We'll be back to talk about True Grit very soon. If you'd like to help other people find this podcast, the best way to do that is to go to iTunes and leave us a review there. If you want to comment on this particular episode, you'll have to visit our home on the web. That's dailyplastic.com. Or you can give us a call at 415-287-4020. We'd love to hear your message and play it on a future podcast. Assuming we can dig our way out of this snow, we'll be back soon. And we'll talk more then. Bye.
So beautifully hypnotic. Where are we all going? What are we all doing? This is what interests a true artist of the film. Michelangelo Antonioni. Obviously one of my heroes. And, it was great fun for me to look at this picture again. I hope you enjoyed it too, and I hope I wasn't too distracting. But it's great.